You are listening to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. And now, here's today's message.
So in the third section of the second panel, found in chapters 25 through 31, we were given instructions for the building of the tabernacle. And we spent 3 weeks exploring the symbolism of the tabernacle in all of its multi-layered glory. So we talked about 7 layers of symbolism in the tabernacle. Does anyone remember what those 7 layers might be? Does anyone have one of those things? The tabernacle is symbolic of, or connected to?
Mount Sinai.
Andrew?
Creation.
Nate?
Garden.
Garden? There we got 3. Mount Sinai, creation, garden. Nate?
Human body.
Who else? Got 4. The ones that were left out is Noah's Ark, the heavenly sanctuary, and the bride. So those were the 7. Of course, it'd be easy to have a longer list or merge them, but 7 is a good number, especially when you're talking about symbolism. In the fourth section of the second panel, found in chapters 32 through 34, so that's what we covered in our last lesson a few weeks ago, we're told of the rebellion of the golden bull or the golden calf, which threatened to derail the new creational project of building the tabernacle. As a result of this rebellion, God threatened to cancel the building of the tabernacle. So all that about, I'm going to go with you, I'm not going to go with you, that's talking about how God threatened, because of their rebellion, to cancel the building of the tabernacle. And as a result of Moses' intercession, the tabernacle was indeed built, and God went with them, which was the goal of Exodus from the beginning. Now, because I want to leave time to recap the book as a whole next week, we're going to be attempting to survey tonight all the way from chapter 35 through 39. As we'll see, and in case you get scared that I'm just going to talk in the same level of detail about all of these chapters just a whole lot faster, I'm not going to do that. Much of the material, apart from some of the things in chapter 35, is a verbatim repetition of what we already covered in chapters 25 through 31. So we're not going to go over all the same details again. I'll just mention a few hints along the way, but we'll look and see some of the differences. So we'll be covering a lot of text, but we'll keep the comments very brief. So the first thing, chapter 35, in verse 1, we begin this section with a command that at first seems rather puzzling. So we've had the instructions for the tabernacle, then we've had the rebellion of the golden calf, and now the tabernacle is going to be built. Moses gathered all the congregation of the children of Israel together. So the tabernacle is going to be the result of the work of, and it's going to be for the benefit of, the entire Israelite community. That's not puzzling. But then we read these words. And said unto them, these are the words which the Lord hath commanded that ye should do them. 6 days shall work be done. But on the 7th day there shall be to you an holy day, a Sabbath of rest to the Lord. Whosoever doeth work therein shall be put to death. Ye shall kindle no fire throughout your habitations upon the Sabbath day. So we're about to build the tabernacle, and then we get a repetition of the Sabbath command. Does anyone have an idea as to why that might be? What was the last, Janine?
Because he already said that he was our rest.
Yeah. But why do you think there's a repetition of the Sabbath command at just this point?
So they don't forget.
But I think that's a big part of it. But I think there's something else going on. Because what was the last, Brother Dave?
Maybe he wants them focused on that, but he doesn't want them focused on the building to the exclusion. Doesn't want them focused on the building to the exclusion of being focused on the Lord.
Yes, I think there's a part of that. I think there's something else going on, though. And that is the very last thing. So remember we talked about that whole symbolic structure of the tabernacle and how you've got the two overlapping patterns of creation? What's the very end of the second pattern? So if you go back to chapter 31, what appears at the end of chapter 31?
Verse
the tables of stone, but right before the tables of stone, in verse 12, the last section is a repetition of the Sabbath command. And so immediately after this, so the Sabbath command is the last instruction given, and then you get to the rebellion of the golden calf. So repeating the Sabbath command as the tabernacle is about to be built is a way of saying that God is picking up where he left off with the people before their rebellion. I think what you said, they don't need to forget it, so it's repeated, that's important. What you said, they shouldn't be working in their zeal to build the tabernacle, they shouldn't work on the Sabbath day, so they should keep the rest that the Lord has called them to in mind. I think there's something to that. But I think the biggest thing that's going on is that God is picking up where he left off. One of my favorite stories in all of church history is Calvin in Geneva. So he was preaching in Geneva, and he got run out of town. They didn't want him anymore. And so he spent a few years in exile, and finally they begged him to come back. And so after like 2 or 3 years in exile, he comes back, and he goes to the pulpit, and he picks up in the next verse where he left off 3 years earlier, as if nothing had happened. Now, of course, everything wasn't as if nothing had happened, but he kept on going with where he had left off. And I think that's what God is doing. Well, I think Calvin was imitating what God is doing here. But I think there's a connection between those two things. So, we're first given the Sabbath command, and then we're told what the Lord commanded. So, first we're told about the raw materials that need to be contributed. That's in verses 4 through 9. And then we're going to be told about the tasks that need to be completed. So, we have this sort of two-section way of looking at it. Here's the stuff, and then here's what needs to be done with that stuff. So, verses 4 through 9. Moses spake unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, this is a thing which the Lord commanded, saying, take ye from among you an offering unto the Lord. Whosoever is of a willing heart, let him bring it. An offering of the Lord, gold and silver and brass, and blue and purple and scarlet, and fine linen and goat's hair, and ram skins dyed red, and badger skins, and shittim wood, and oil for the light, and spices for the anointing oil, and for the sweet incense, and onyx stones and stones to be set for the ephod and for the breastplate. So these are the same materials that we find listed in 25, 1 through 9. And when we talked about chapter 25, we discussed some of the significant things about these different materials at that point. So first we get a list of the materials. Then starting in verse 10, we get a summary of all the things that need to be made, all the tasks that need to be accomplished for this tabernacle to become a reality. Verse 10, and every wise-hearted among you shall come and make all that the Lord hath commanded. The tabernacle, his tent, his covering, his taches, his boards, his bars, his pillars, his sockets, the ark, and the staves thereof, with the mercy seat and the veil of the covering. Here's a little detail that wasn't mentioned earlier. So as we go through this, most of it is verbatim repetition, but there's some details that were mentioned earlier, and then there's some details that are mentioned here, but not earlier. And here's one of those details that's added, and that is that when the tabernacle was disassembled for moving, it was the veil that separated the most holy place from the holy place that was used to cover the ark. So when they took the tabernacle apart, the first thing that would happen is the high priest would go in, he'd take the veil down, and he'd cover the ark of the covenant. Numbers 4:5, when the camp setteth forward, Aaron shall come and his sons, and they shall take down the covering veil and cover the ark of testimony with it. So there was an extra step of precaution around the ark of the covenant that wasn't taken for any other portion of the tabernacle, and the veil was what was used for that. So that's just a little detail that's there in the text. Verse 13, the table and his staves and all his vessels and the showbread, the candlestick also for the light and his furniture and his lamps with the oil for the light and the incense altar and his staves and the anointing oil and the sweet incense. And the hanging for the door at the entering of the tabernacle, the altar of burnt offering, and his brazen grate, his staves, and all his vessels, the laver and his foot, the hangings of the court, his pillars and their sockets, and the hanging for the door of the court, the pins of the tabernacle, and the pins of the court, and their cords, the cloths of service to do service in the holy place, the holy garments for Aaron the priest, and the garments of his sons to minister in the priest's office. And so we have these instructions. Here is what the Lord commanded to do. Gather the materials together, and then use those materials to make all the stuff that is required for the tabernacle to be organized and set up. After Moses commands the people, that's verses 1 through 19, then in verse 20 we're told how the people responded. So the people's response goes from 35:20 through 36:7. And the people respond by gathering materials and then organizing for the tasks. So 35, verse 20. All the congregation of the children of Israel departed from the presence of Moses. And they came, everyone whose heart stirred him up, and everyone whom his spirit made willing. And they brought the Lord's offering to the work of the tabernacle of the congregation and for all his service and for the holy garments. After the restoration of fellowship, the hearts of the children of Israel were not like the heart of Pharaoh. So when God judged Pharaoh, Pharaoh's heart became harder and more stubborn, leaden and more leaden. More and more stiff his neck became. But after God disciplined the children of Israel, their hearts became willing to do the work of God. They were eager and responsive to the commands of God. So Pharaoh became less and less responsive, but the children of Israel became responsive and more obedient. 2 Corinthians 9:7 says this, "Every man, according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver." And they came, verse 22, both men and women, as many as were willing-hearted, and they brought bracelets and earrings and rings and tablets, all jewels of gold. There's an emphasis throughout this section about the materials being gathered. There's an emphasis on the inclusion and the contribution that was made by women. But one of the things we're going to see is that what the women contribute is not the same thing as the men contribute. Both of them contribute. Both of them have a stake in the tabernacle. But they contribute, the men as men and the women as women. Verse 22, "Every man that offered, offered an offering of gold unto the Lord. And every man with whom was found blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen and goat's hair and red skins of rams and badger skins brought them. Everyone that did an offering of silver and brass brought the Lord's offering. And every man with whom was found shittim wood for any work of the service brought it." So the men bring an offering. "And all the women that were wise-hearted did spin with their hands and brought that which they had spun, both of blue and of purple and of scarlet and of fine linen. And all the women whose hearts stirred them up in wisdom spun goat's hair." So we have a division of labor that's taking here. We're not told that the women went out and cut down trees and brought them to the construction site. We're not told that the men sat at home and spun goat's hair. We're told that the men brought the trees and the women did the spinning. The women's work was primarily domestic, but the women's work was oriented towards the goal of the community as a whole for the construction of the tabernacle. The women had a valuable, an equally valuable role to play in what God had commanded the community to do. But the women didn't find their value in acting like second-class men. And the men didn't find their value in acting like second-class women. Because a man is never going to be as good as a woman at doing woman's work. And a woman is never going to do as good as a man at doing man's work. But a woman can do a woman's work quite well. And a man can do a man's work quite well. And a flourishing community is built on recognizing the difference between the two, not eliminating the distinctives. The women were not oppressed because they didn't go cut down acacia trees and haul them to the construction site. Verse 27, "And the rulers brought onyx stones and stones to be set for the ephod and for the breastplate." We've been told about what the men and the women did, that there was a distinction between the labor of the men and the labor of the women. But now we're giving an even more countercultural picture. Now we're told about how the tribal leaders or the chieftains participated. So gold is divisible. If I have an ounce of gold, I can divide that into 10 1/10 of an ounce. And then that could be divided into 10 1/100 piece of an ounce. So if we need gold, and all of us are reasonably poor, but we all have a little bit of gold, we could take all the gold, and we could melt it down, and we could get enough gold. But you can't do that with precious stones. If you take a diamond, and you smash it into little bits, and everybody takes their little bit home, are the little bits together worth as much as the diamond was before it was smashed? Not even close. A large precious stone is an accumulation of value, a significant accumulation of value, that you can't put a bunch of little stones together and get the sort of large stone that was needed for the high priest's breastplate. So if the community was to be able to access the sort of gemstones that were needed for the high priest's breastplate and some other elements of the tabernacle, the community needed to include wealthy individuals. The community needed leaders. The community needed a hierarchy, in other words. Hierarchy can go wrong. It can be oppressive. When you have some people above other people, they can use their abilities, whether that is wealth in terms of possessing a gemstone or some other form of wealth, or whether it's simply ability, that some people are better than other people at some things. Some people have an expertise that others don't have, and that expertise or that wealth or that power can be used in oppressive ways. That's true. But egalitarianism, where everyone does the same thing, cannot be used in any good way. It's just ugly and boring. Right? Hierarchy can go wrong, but egalitarianism can't go right because it goes against the creational order that God has designed. Not everyone is equally skilled or wealthy or influential or powerful. Men contribute differently from women. Adults contribute differently from children. The elderly contribute differently from the young. Everyone has a role to play, but everyone's role is distinct. And when you reject that, you create an ugly and boring society. Look around you. That's what we've created. Verse 28. And spice and oil for the light and for the anointing oil and for the sweet incense. The children of Israel brought a willing offering unto the Lord, every man and woman whose heart made them willing to bring for all manner of work, which the Lord hath commanded to be made by the hand of Moses. Though different individuals work differently, they all contributed to this same task. So having gathered the materials, it was now time to organize to accomplish the task. So God commands them, gather materials, accomplish these tasks. They've gathered the materials, now they're going to assemble workers to get the job done. Moses said unto the children of Israel, see, the Lord hath called by name Bezaleel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and he hath filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom and understanding and knowledge and in all manner of workmanship. The new creation of the tabernacle is overshadowed by the hovering Spirit of God, just as was the first creation. Verse 32, and to devise curious works, to work in gold and in silver and in brass, that is bronze, and in the cutting of stones to set them, and in the carving of wood to make any manner of cunning work. And he hath put in his heart that he may teach both he and Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach of the tribe of Dan. And them hath he filled with wisdom of heart to work all manner of work of the engraver and of the cunning workman and of the embroiderer in blue and in purple and in scarlet and in fine linen and of the weaver, even of them that do any work and of those that devise cunning work. Something to know here, Bezaleel and Aholiab are both skilled. They have these skills that they learned and they're filled with the Spirit. And something you should notice, where did they learn these skills? What do you think Bezaleel learned how to do three different kinds of weaving? In verse 35, there are three different words for different sorts of weaving. These are highly specialized skills. Where did they learn these skills? They learned them in Egypt. They learned them working on Pharaoh's pointless building projects. Sometimes God has you in a place where you're doing things that don't seem to make any difference to you, but you don't know what skills you're developing that maybe he has for you to need some point down the road. Not only that, but the filling of the Spirit doesn't replace the need to learn skill. It enables them to use the skill to the glory of God. It's not like they're these unskilled people whom the Spirit of God strikes and voila, they're a magician with the weaver's web. No, they're magician weavers. It's not like the Spirit of God is like, well, they're not very interested in serving God, but they've got the skills, so they're going to get the job. No, it's a combination. It's both of those things. We saw that with Moses. Moses had the training and the ability to lead the people of God, but in order to lead the people of God to God's glory, he also needed the gifting of the Spirit. It's not an either or, but a both and. As I mentioned earlier, there's a striking connection between the word that's translated as master builder in 1 Corinthians 3 and the word that's translated as cunning workman here and in Exodus 31. Paul intentionally, in other words, links his labors to found a church in Corinth to the labors of Bezaleel and Aholiab. He uses words that are a clear link. They're unusual words that he links his labors to the labor of Bezaleel and Aholiab. Not only that, what was Paul's profession by trade? He's a tent maker. Bezaleel and Aholiab were also tent makers. And here's a connection between the building up of the church and the building of the tabernacle. The church is the dwelling place of God, just as the tabernacle was called to be. And it's no surprise that God called a tent maker to be foundational in seeing the church established. 36 and verse 1. Then wrought Bezalel and Aholiab and every wise-hearted man in whom the Lord put wisdom and understanding to know how to work all manner of work for the service of the sanctuary, according to all that the Lord had commanded. And Moses called Bezalel and Aholiab, and every wise-hearted man in whose heart the Lord had put wisdom, even every one whose heart stirred him up to come unto the work to do it. And they received of Moses all the offering which the children of Israel had brought for the work of the service of the sanctuary to make it withal. And they brought yet unto him free offerings every morning. And all the wise men that wrought all the work of the sanctuary came every man from his work which they made. And they spake unto Moses, saying, the people bring much more than enough for the service of the work which the Lord commanded to make. And Moses gave commandment, and they caused it to be proclaimed throughout the camp, saying, let neither man nor woman make any more work for the offering of the sanctuary. So the people were restrained from bringing, for the stuff they had was sufficient for all the work to make it, and too much. With the materials gathered, they began to get to work. But so much was being given that they had more than they needed, and they had to tell the people, stop giving. You women, stop weaving. We've got goat's hair coming out of our ears. We don't need any more, right? We've got enough stuff to get this tabernacle done. So we're not just going to accumulate more stuff. We're going to actually get to work. So with the materials gathered and the workmen and the women busy, we're told that the actual construction of the tabernacle. And so in 36:8 through 38:20, we see the actual construction of the tabernacle itself in 10 steps. Now, as I mentioned early in the introduction, 36 through 38 repeat most of the time, word by word, the instructions given in 25 through 31. While there are a few details given here, not given earlier, and there are more details given earlier that are left out here, almost everything is word for word exactly the same, though, of course, it, as we'll see, it's arranged in a very different order. So here's a question. Why is it in a book that leaves out, there's so many things that happen in the book of Exodus that are so important. The rescue of God's people from slavery, the giving of the covenant on Mount Sinai, these are central events in biblical history that were given very few details about, the crossing of the Red Sea. And many details are left out. But all these details about the tabernacle that we modern people find hard to read enough the first time, we're given twice. In excruciating detail, twice. Why is that? Why do we get so many details twice? Well, there's a few reasons we can point out. Number one, to emphasize just how important it is. The primary reason is to emphasize the importance of the tabernacle. The Exodus served the tabernacle, not the other way around. If we want more information about the crossing of the Red Sea and less information about the construction of the tabernacle, then our priorities are out of line with God's priorities. Our taste doesn't conform to his taste. He's telling us what's actually important. This is what he thought his people needed to know about. The tabernacle was the goal from the beginning. The tabernacle was the means by which Eden would begin to be restored, the center of God's redemptive plans for his people. So God thought we needed to know all these details about it to draw our attention to just how significant it was. Sometimes the things that we think are boring and dull and repetitive are the very things that God thinks are the most important, most exciting, and most relevant to our lives. We are not always the best judges of what is relevant, significant, or interesting. God is. And we need to conform our taste to his. The tabernacle was also that which would unite Israel as a nation, giving it a symbolic center. As a nation of escaped slaves, Israel was in constant danger of degenerating into a messy mob. That's what happened with the golden bull, the golden calf, as they're worshiping it. They're disintegrating into a disorganized, chaotic rabble. It turns into a riot. And a riot is a bad way to form a nation. The tabernacle is what gives unity to these disparate tribes, 12 different tribes that were in competition with one another and had different traditions from one another and could have become 12 separate people. But the tabernacle held them together. And it's no accident that in the book of Numbers, we see the children of Israel, each in their individual tribes, being organized around the tabernacle. Tabernacle at the center, four tribes here, four tribes here, four tribes here, four tribes here. The tabernacle, by the power of its symbolism, holds the people together. One of the reasons that our nation is beginning to fall apart at the seams is because we have no symbols that hold us together. We think of symbolism as just this icing on the cake, but symbolism is actually what binds a people together, what takes a disparate mass of individuals and forms them and holds them together into a people. This is why the Romans were so concerned that everyone give incense to Caesar, because incense to Caesar was what was holding the empire together. So when the Christians refused to go along, they were striking at the heart of Caesar's lordship. It really was a big deal, because Jesus is Lord and Caesar is not, and Caesar's lordship had to go. Refusing to bow the knee to Caesar was more threatening to Caesar than trying to blow up the imperial palace. We need to remember and realize that us gathering for worship and us giving our allegiance to Jesus is a direct challenge to this world system. A more direct challenge than violent military or political action. It is political action. Worship is political, because shared worship is what holds nations together. And often that shared worship is shared idolatry. So that's one of the reasons, the significance of the tabernacle. A second reason why we find this repeated is the idea of obedience. We're going to find this theme over and over again, that Moses did exactly what God said. God said this, the people did that. There's something else, though, in this theme of obedience, and that is the tabernacle, because of the episode with the golden bull, was under threat, right? God said, here's how you're going to build the tabernacle. And then God said, I'm not going to go with you. Cancel the tabernacle. I'm not going up in your midst. But the repetition lets us know that despite the rebellion of the people, the tabernacle that was built conformed exactly to the instructions that were given. Not one piece of furniture was taken away. Not one curtain was cut differently. Moses' intercessions had been fully successful, and the tabernacle was built according to the vision that was given. So that's a significant reason why we have this repetition. There's a third reason, the ordering of it. As I mentioned earlier, when we went through the instructions for the tabernacle, I pointed out what I would see. It's not original to me, but what seems to be a creational pattern where the arrangement in the first instructions matches the pattern of the day of creation, the days of creation, and you sort of have this double echoing of the days of creation in the instructions. But when we get to the actual execution of those instructions, we'll find that the material is ordered completely differently. It's completely straightforward. First you get the tent, then you get the skeleton, then you get the items in the tent, all four of the golden items together. So all of the odd arrangement that drew our attention to this pattern of echoes in the first section, we don't find in the second section. Well, one of the things that does, by having these two different patterns, helps us to see the significance that something's going on in the arrangement of this material. There's some reason for it. Maybe we can't be completely dogmatic as to what that reason is, but there's some reason why these three items are described separately from this one, right? There's something that's going on in that first section that we wouldn't be able to see if we didn't have another section where it was arranged differently. So it helps us to see some of the symbolism that's at work in the previous section by having one that's arranged more straightforwardly. So that's a reason for the repetition. There's one last reason for the repetition, and that is style. As it turns out, this style of giving very detailed instructions and then repeating those instructions verbatim with past verbs is a characteristic of writing from the time and place that the description of the tabernacle, the book of Exodus, purports to be from. It's something we find in writings from ancient Ugarit around the time of the tabernacle, and it's something we don't find in later books of the Bible or in later books from other places in the ancient world. In other words, the stylistic features of the tabernacle are a strong apologetic reason that this was actually written at the time it purports to be written from. So it's like there's certain styles or certain ways of saying things that you get in the Constitution that you wouldn't get from a document written, say, in the 20th century. So if you had a bunch of people who were saying, well, no, the Constitution is a conspiracy that people dreamed up in World War II, you'd be able to say, look at all these things. People don't write this way today, but they did write that way back then. And so we can say it actually goes back to the time and place it comes from. So it's actually a little bit of support for the fact that this is not a later invention, but actually goes back to where it says it comes from. Hopefully that made sense, but that was something that I had never thought of or heard before in reading for this that struck me as very interesting. So with that being said, it's time to work through this repetition. Since we've already covered this, and also for the sake of time, I'll keep comment down to a minimum, so we won't be explaining all the details. But it's striking, in this case, that the carrying out of the instructions is related in what seemed to me to be 10 distinct steps, paralleling the 10 words of creation, the 10 blows of decreation, and the 10 words of recreation. So we have 10 steps, and you can see those outlined in your notes. First, we're told about the symbolic skin of the tabernacle, the four-layered curtain that covered it. Exodus 36 and verse 8. And every wise-hearted man among them that wrought the work of the tabernacle made 10 curtains of fine twined linen and blue and purple and scarlet, with cherubims of cunning work made he them. The length of one curtain was 28 cubits, and the breadth of one curtain 4 cubits. The curtains were all of one size. And he coupled the 5 curtains one into another, and the other 5 curtains he coupled one into another. And he made loops of blue on the edge of one curtain from the selvage in the coupling. Likewise he made in the uttermost side of another curtain in the coupling of the second. 50 loops made he in one curtain, and 50 loops made he in the edge of the curtain which was in the coupling of the second. The loops held one curtain to another. And he made 50 tatches of gold and coupled the curtains one unto another with the tatches, so it became one tabernacle or one tent. So we have embroidered linen curtains as part of the skin. The second layer of skin is curtains of woven goat's hair. And he made curtains of goat's hair for the tent over the tabernacle, 11 curtains he made them. The length of one curtain was 30 cubits, and 4 cubits was the breadth of one curtain. The 11 curtains were of one size, and he coupled 5 curtains by themselves, and 6 curtains by themselves. And he made 50 loops upon the uttermost edge of the curtain in the coupling, and 50 loops made he upon the edge of the curtain which coupleth the second. And he made 50 tatches of brass to couple the tent together, that it might be one. Then we find the ram's skins dyed red. Verse 19, he made a covering for the tent of ram's skins dyed red, and then a covering of badger skins, which most likely is not the leather of badgers, but probably dugong skin, as we talked about in some detail before. So you've got 4 levels. You've got embroidered linen. You have woven goat's hair. You've got ram skins dyed red or goat leather. And then you have this dugong leather. So you have 4 layers of skin for the tabernacle. Next, we get the skeleton of the tabernacle. He made boards for the tabernacle of shittim or acacia wood standing up. The length of a board or a frame, these would have been hollow frames, not solid boards, but the length of one of the frames was 10 cubits and the breadth of a board, 1 cubit and a half. One board had 2 tenons, equally distant one from another. Thus did he make for all the boards of the tabernacle. And he made boards for the tabernacle, 20 boards for the south side southward, and 40 sockets of silver he made under the 20 boards. 2 sockets under one board for his 2 tenons, and 2 sockets under another board for his 2 tenons. And for the other side of the tabernacle, which is toward the north corner, he made 20 boards, and the 40 sockets of silver, 2 sockets under one board, and 2 sockets under another board. And for the sides of the tabernacle westward, he made 6 boards, and 2 boards made he for the corners of the tabernacle and the 2 sides, and they were coupled beneath and coupled together at the head thereof to one ring. Thus he did to both of them in both the corners. And there were 8 boards, and their sockets were 16 sockets of silver under every board, 2 sockets. And he made bars of shittim or acacia wood, 5 for the boards of the one side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards of the other side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards of the tabernacle for the sides westward. And he made the middle bar to shoot through the boards from the one end to the other. And he overlaid the boards with gold, and made the rings of gold to be places for the bars, and overlaid the bars with gold. Made of a skin and a skeleton, the tabernacle, as we saw, is a symbolic human body. And there are strong connections between the building of the tabernacle and the language that is used for these ribs, for the tabernacle, and the language that is used for the construction of Eve, who is made of Adam's rib. The word, it's actually, she, you know, he sort of built her from a beam. It's architectural terms that are used in Genesis 2, the same terms that we find used here in the tabernacle. And it's no surprise, then, that we find connections between the tabernacle and the church. And the church is the bride of Christ, and Eve is the bride of Adam. And Christ is the second Adam, and Adam is the first Adam. There's a web of symbolic connections that are going on here. So we find the skin, and we find the skeleton of the tabernacle, and then we get the dividers of the tabernacle. 36, 35, he made a veil of blue and purple and scarlet. And fine twined linen with cherubims made he yet of cunning work. And he made thereunto four pillars of shittim wood, and he overlaid them with gold. Their hooks were of gold, and he cast for them four sockets of silver. And he made an hanging for the tabernacle door of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twined linen of needlework. And the five pillars of it with their hooks, and he overlaid their chapiters and their fillets with gold, but their five sockets were of brass. The arrangement of the tabernacle. The arrangement of the tabernacle into three sections, an outer barrier, and then a holy place. And then a most holy place where the presence of God dwelt, of course, is what turns the tabernacle into a portable Mount Sinai. And there's a lot of connections we explored about that. Having described the construction of the tent itself, so we had the skin and the skeleton and the dividers, now our attention is turned to the four golden items at the heart of the tabernacle, beginning with the ark. And each of these items symbolizes something vital about the relationship of God with his people. Chapter 37 and verse 1. And Bezaleel made the ark of shittim wood, 2 cubits and a half was the length thereof of it, and 1 cubit and a half the breadth of it, and 1 cubit and a half the height of it. And he overlaid it with pure gold within and without, and made a crown of gold to it round about. And he cast for it 4 rings of gold to be set by the 4 corners of it, even 2 rings upon the one side of it, and 2 rings upon the other side of it. And he made staves of shittim wood, and overlaid them with gold, and he put the staves into the rings by the sides of the ark to bear the ark. And he made the mercy seat of pure gold. 2 cubits and a half was the length thereof, and 1 cubit and a half the breadth thereof. And he made 2 cherubims of gold. Beaten out of 1 piece made he them. On the 2 ends of the mercy seat, 1 cherub on the end on this side, and another cherub on the other end on that side, out of the mercy seat made he the cherubim on the 2 sides ends thereof. And the cherubim spread out their wings on high and covered with their wings over the mercy seat, with their faces one to another, even to the mercy seat, even to the mercy seatward were the faces of the cherubim. The ark, as the earthly footstool of God's heavenly throne, is this image we find all throughout the scripture that's just remarkable. That it's the idea that the ark is the footstool and God's throne is in heaven, and it's that point of connection between the heavenly sanctuary and the earthly tabernacle. It represents God's presence with his people. Filled with cherubim, the tabernacle is an earthly model of God's heavenly throne room. What are on the feet of God's throne room? As you look upward, we find this described in Ezekiel. God is riding on a chariot composed of cherubim. So beyond the cherubim, beyond the living creatures, is where God is. And so when you have a veil that is like the heavens, blue and purple, covered in cherubim, it's like the vision of God's throne that Ezekiel sees looking upward has been placed on its side. And then you have the Ark of the Covenant as the footstool of God's heavenly throne. It's a symbol of God's presence with his people, and yet the reality that God's presence exceeds the grasp of his people. God cannot be contained in the tabernacle, even though through the tabernacle he is present with his people. Then we find the table. 37 and verse 10. He made the table of shittim wood. 2 cubits was the length thereof, and 1 cubit the breadth thereof, and 1 cubit and a half the height thereof. And he overlaid it with pure gold, and made thereunto a crown of gold round about. Also he made thereunto a border of an handbreadth round about, and made a crown of gold for the border thereof round about, and he cast for it 4 rings of gold, and put the rings upon the 4 corners that were in the 4 feet thereof. Over against the border were the rings, the places for the staves to bear the table. He made the staves of shittim wood, and overlaid them with gold to bear the table. Then we find verse 16. He made the vessels which were upon the table, his dishes and his spoons, his bowls, and his covers to cover with all of pure gold. We'll come back to that in a second. The table represents God's communion with his people, shared table fellowship. And while the King James follows, as it sometimes does, a particular rabbinic tradition in verse 16, the rendering of the ESV is a much more natural rendering of the Hebrew. He made the vessels of pure gold that were to be on the table, its places, plates and dishes for incense, and its bowls and flagons with which to pour drink offerings. Now, does anyone remember, we talked about the drink offerings, but I didn't see this connection until just now. Does anyone remember what those drink offerings were? What was to be poured out morning and evening with every sacrifice in the tabernacle?
Wine.
Wine was to be poured out. And so these vessels for the drink offering is the word that's used for the vessels for the drink offering. So these would have been a wine jar that was placed along with the bread. Now, wine was not poured out within the tabernacle itself. That was poured out on the altar of burnt offering. But you have a table on which is set bread and wine. A symbolic banquet. And a pointing forward to the Lord's Supper, just as the Lord's Supper is pointing back to the fellowship that God had with his people through bread and wine. And of course, you also have Melchizedek bringing forth bread and wine and a connection between Melchizedek's priesthood and that of Christ. So just as Melchizedek brought out bread and wine, so Christ brings out bread and wine and he participates with his people. And it's a symbolic banquet between God and his people, just as the Lord's Supper is for us. I thought that was really neat, and I didn't see that the first time through because I was not seeing the way that that should be translated. So we have the ark, we have the table, we get the lampstand. Verse 17, he made the candlestick of pure gold. Of beaten work made he the candlestick. His shaft and his branch, his bowls, his knops, and his flowers were of the same. And six branches going out of the sides thereof. Three branches of the candlestick out of the one side thereof, and three branches of the candlestick out of the other side thereof. Three bowls made after the fashion of almonds in one branch, a knop and a flower. Three bowls made like almonds in the other branch, a knop and a flower. And so throughout the six branches going out of the candlestick. And in the candlestick were four bowls made like almonds, his knops and his flowers, and a knop under two branches of the same, and a knop under two branches of the same, and a knop under two branches of the same, according to the six branches going out of it. Their knops and their branches were of the same. All of it was one beaten work of pure gold. And he made his seven lamps and his snuffers and his snuff dishes of pure gold. Of a talent of pure gold made he it and all the vessels thereof. The lampstand symbolizes the light that God provides for his people in the darkness of this world. I'm sorry, Brother RJ, for the signing of that. What's going on with all the almonds and the knops and the bowls and all of that? Well, it's being described in terms of a almond tree, or a tree of life, a reminder of the Garden of Eden. It's a symbolic tree of life, and of course you have the 3 plus 1 plus 3 pattern, 3 plus 3 plus 1 pattern of creation, and of course you also have a picture of the seven light-bearing planets because it represents the visible heavens. There are lots of layers of symbolism going on with the lampstand, but we can't dig into all those details again. Then we find the fourth golden item at the heart of the tabernacle, and this is the one that in the first telling, the instructions, it's separated off and provides the key to seeing the whole creational pattern that's going on there. It's the incense altar. 37 and verse 25, he made the incense altar of shittim wood. The length of it was a cubit, the breadth of it a cubit. It was four square, and the two cubits was the height of it. The horns thereof were of the same, and he overlaid it with pure gold, both the top of it and the sides thereof round about, and the horns of it. Also he made unto it a crown of gold round about. And he made two rings of gold for it under the crown thereof by the two corners of it, upon the two sides thereof, to be places for the staves to bear it withal. And he made the staves of shittim wood and overlaid them with gold. And he made the holy anointing oil and the pure incense of sweet spices according to the work of the apothecary. The incense altar, as we saw, symbolizes the prayers that God's people offer to him, another part of their communion with him. So having finished with the four golden items at the heart of the tabernacle, so we talked about the skin and the skeleton, and then the four golden items, the ark and the table and the lampstand and the incense altar, then we move outside to the courtyard. So we can see that the arrangement of these 10 steps, this arrangement of the material, is a very logical, orderly progression. But that draws our attention, then, to the symbolic theological progression that's given in the instructions. There's something going on there, and this helps us to see that. Chapter 38 in verse 1. And he made the altar of burnt offering of shittim wood. 5 cubits was the length thereof, and 5 cubits the breadth thereof. It was 4 square, and 3 cubits the height thereof. And he made the horns thereof on the 4 corners of it. The horns thereof were of the same, and he overlaid it with brass. And he made all the vessels of the altar, the pots, and the shovels, and the basins, and the flesh hooks, and the fire pans. All the vessels thereof he made of brass that we would call today bronze. And he made for the altar a brazen gate of network under the compass thereof, beneath under the midst of it. And he cast four rings for the four ends of the grate of brass to be places for the staves. And he made the staves of shittim wood and overlaid them with brass or bronze. And he put the staves into the rings on the sides of the altar to bear it withal. He made the altar hollow with boards. And so, as we talked about, this altar was sort of a hollow framework. And when they set it up, they would fill it with dirt. And then on that altar of earth, as we are told in Exodus 24, they would offer their sacrifices. This altar pictures this dedication that is required to worship and the sacrifice of atonement that connects the people to God. So all the animal sacrifices would be offered on this brazen altar. And as the people would put their hands on their offerings and those offerings would be offered up as their representatives, they would be connected to God. Verse 8 of chapter 38. And he made the laver of brass and the foot of it of brass. Then we get this puzzling thing. This is one of those puzzling little details that is not in the previous section. Of the looking glasses of the women assembling, which assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. Now, in the ancient world, mirrors were made of polished bronze or copper. Glass hadn't been invented yet, like a silver-coated glass mirror. That hadn't been invented yet, and so people would have highly polished metal discs. And that's how they would look at themselves and see their reflection and do their makeup or whatever else it was they were doing. So that's clear, how you would make a laver out of polished bronze. That's not too difficult. But who are these women? What was their role? Well, we don't really know. We do know they are mentioned in 1 Samuel chapter 2. Eli was very old and heard all that his sons did unto all Israel and how they lay with the women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. The same description is used. Exactly how to translate this is puzzling. So it could be the ministering women who ministered at the entrance of the tent of meeting or something like that. So these women did something at the tent of meeting, but we don't really know what that was. And we don't really know what their role was or why they had these mirrors. But we do know that they had something that was precious to them that they gave up so that this particular item could be constructed and God commemorated their giving. That's what we do know. And it's interesting that when the total of the bronze, we're going to get in a moment to the tally of so much gold, so much silver, and all these things were made of so much gold, and these are the things that were made of gold, so much silver, and these are the things that were made of silver, so much bronze, and these are the things that were made of bronze. And it's interesting that the laver is left out of the tally. So here was the total offering of bronze, and here's the things that were made from that offering, but the laver isn't on that list because the laver wasn't made from the general offering of everyone bringing bronze. The laver was made from a particular gift by a particular group of people. We don't know who those people were. We don't know why their bronze was required. We don't know what made it special. We don't know any of those things. But we do know that a particular gift was made. And thousands of years later, we are still reading about that gift. And when we give something up for God's glory, whatever it is, we have no way of knowing where that story is going to end. Laver represents symbolically preparation for worship. Then we come last but not least to the courtyard, 38 and verse 9. And he made the court on the south side southward. The hangings of the court were fine twined linen, 100 cubits. The pillars were 20. The brazen sockets 20. The hooks of the pillars and the fillets were of silver. And for the north side, the hangings were 100 cubits. Their pillars were 20. Their sockets of brass 20. The hooks of the pillars and their fillets of silver. And for the west side were hangings of 50 cubits, their pillars 10, their sockets 10, the hooks of the pillars and their fillets of silver. And for the east side, eastward, 50 cubits, the hangings of the one side of the gate were 15 cubits, their pillars 3, their sockets 3. And for the other side of the court gate, on this hand and on that hand, were hangings of 15 cubits, their pillars 3, and their sockets 3. All the hangings of the court round about were of fine twined linen, and the sockets for the pillars were of brass, the hooks of the pillars and the fillets of silver, and the overlaying of their chapiters of silver, and all the pillars of the court were filleted with silver. And the hanging for the gate of the court was needlework of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twined linen, and 20 cubits was the height, and the height in the breadth was 5 cubits. 20 cubits was the length, sorry. And the height in the breadth was 5 cubits, answerable to the hangings of the court. And their pillars were 4, and their sockets of brass 4, their hooks of silver, and the overlaying of their chapiters and their fillets of silver, and all the pins of the tabernacle and of the court round about were of brass. So, the end of the description, we get the courtyard. And the courtyard is what separated the enclosure of the tabernacle from the world. So if we're thinking about the tabernacle as a miniature cosmos, then we have the Gentile seas, the Israelite land, the heavens that can be seen, and the heavens above the heavens where God's throne room is. As we go from outside, so we're outside in the seas, the chaotic land that is not organized. And then we come into the land and the holy place, and then we go in, and we have the lights, the 7 lights symbolizing the 7 planets, and we're in the heaven, and of course the priest's garments are like wings that enable them to enter into the heavens, and then above the heavens we have the throne of God. So you have the symbolic cosmos, or the microcosm of the universe, and then of course you also have Mount Sinai, which itself is a microcosm of the universe. But it's embodied in the tabernacle, that you have the barrier that was set up around the base of the mountain, and the holy place where you had the halfway up the mountain, where the elders and the leaders ascended to eat and drink with God. Why is there a table in the tabernacle? Well, because there was a table in the holy place on Mount Sinai. And then the top of the tabernacle, you have the smoking presence of God that descended in the glory cloud on the very top of the mountain. And God spoke from the top of the mountain. And of course, it's no surprise that God speaks from between the cherubim at the top of the tabernacle. So you have these overlapping layers of symbolism. Why do they all connect in this way? Because the world is all the creation of God in this way. And God's creation connects each layer to the other and interprets each layer the other. So the tabernacle is a new creation in miniature. After the 10 steps of constructing the tabernacle and its furniture, we're given a summary of the materials used. This separates off the garments of the priest so that we have 10 steps for the tabernacle. So you may wonder why I'm saying we have these 10 steps. Well, because there's something odd. Like, you have to look at the details of the text and then ask yourselves why. And you may not always be certain that you get it exactly right, but there's a reason it's arranged in this way. So we have, here's the tabernacle, and then we find the summary of materials that's used, and the summary of tasks performed, and those are separated by the garments of the high priest. So in other words, you would expect to find, here's all the things described, and then here's the summary at the end. But you don't find that. You find this one section separated off. And I think the reason that section is separated off is so that you get 10 steps, like the 10 plagues, like the 10 words, like the 10 words of creation and the 10 words of recreation. I think there's something to that. But we find 38, verse 21, the summary of the materials used. This is the sum of the tabernacle, even of the tabernacle of testimony, as it was counted. According to the commandment of Moses for the service of the Levites by the hand of Ithamar, son to Aaron the priest. Bezaleel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, made all that the Lord commanded Moses. And with him was Aholiab, son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan, an engraver, and a cunning workman, and an embroiderer in blue and in purple and in scarlet and fine linen. So we're going to find the sum of the funds that were used, and that's letting us know that the funds were tracked carefully. There was a lot of money sloshing around as the tabernacle was being built. Of course, they didn't use money in the sense that we use money today. That was a later invention, standard coinage. But there was a lot of precious metal going around. And it could have been possible, or you might have thought, all that going around, all these skilled workers being trusted with so much, maybe there's a little going in the back pocket. And the text tells us no. Every last shekel was accounted for. Not only were the people willing to work, they were working for the benefit of the community as a whole and the glory of God. They weren't working to enrich themselves and get rich off the construction of the tabernacle. All the gold that was occupied. So first we find the gold, then we find the silver, then we find the bronze. All the gold that was occupied for the work and all the work of the holy place, even the gold of the offering, was 20 and 9 talents and 730 shekels after the shekel of the sanctuary. And then we find, verse 25, we find the silver. And the silver of them that were numbered of the congregation was 100 talents, and 1,700, 75 shekels after the shekel of the sanctuary, a becah for every man, that is half a shekel after the shekel of the sanctuary, for every one that went to be numbered from 20 years old and upward, for 600,550 men. And of the 100 talents of silver were cast the sockets of the sanctuary and the sockets of the veil, 100 sockets of the 100 talents, a talent for a socket. And of the 1,775 shekels, he made hooks for the pillars and overlaid their chapiters and filleted them. The silver came from the census that was commanded in Exodus 30, verses 12 through 16. And despite the rendering of most English translations, not just the King James, there is good reason to see this census as applying to the whole congregation, women as well as men, not just to men. I'm not going to go into all the details of the translations of the different passages, but as I argued much earlier in the series, going back all the way to Exodus chapter 12, for a number of reasons, it seems most likely if you start adding the numbers of the firstborn and the numbers of the men and the women, you start trying to make all the numbers add up, there's good reason to think that this total of 600,000 is not 600,000 men plus women and children, but 600,000 men and women plus children. So I won't argue if you feel differently, but it seems like that makes the most sense of the text on a whole. And then when you get the sense of the text on the whole, then that affects how you translate each individual section. So we have the gold, we have the silver, we have the bronze. And the brass or the bronze of the offering was 70 talents and 2,400 shekels. And therewith he made the sockets to the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and the brazen altar and the brazen gate for it, and all the vessels of the altar and the sockets of the court round about, and the sockets of the court gate, and all the pins of the tabernacle and all the pins of the court round about. As I mentioned earlier, the laver isn't mentioned because the bronze for that didn't come from this offering, but it came from the mirrors of the serving women. So we have gold, and the gold is tallied, and we're told all the things that were made of the gold. Then we have the silver, and the silver is tallied, and all the things that were made of silver. And then we find the bronze, and the bronze is tallied, and all the things that were made of the bronze of the offering, plus one extra bronze thing that's not tallied because it was made from another source. So after this first summary of materials, so keeping the big picture, we have God coming back, Moses coming and saying, the tabernacle is going to be built, and we're going to pick up where we left off with instructions for the Sabbath. And God commands, gather these materials, accomplish these tasks. So the people gather these materials, and then they begin to accomplish the tasks. And we find, here are the things that needed to be made, and these things have all been made. And then we're given a summary of the gold, silver, and bronze that were used. And now we're being told of one additional task that needed to be done, namely garments for the priests that separated off from the 10 steps of the tabernacle itself. 39 in verse 1. And of the blue and purple and scarlet, they made cloths of service to do service in the holy place. And they made the holy garments for Aaron as the Lord commanded Moses. So we're told first about the ephod. The ephod was a kind of apron that went over the garment of the high priest. As I mentioned earlier, the garments of the high priest are the priest is garbed like the tabernacle is garbed. So the priest is like a walking tabernacle. These garments are like his wings that it conform him to the heavens of the tabernacle. But it also is the people couldn't see inside the tabernacle, but the people could see the priest. And the priest was like the tabernacle turned inside out. So if you have the tabernacle, you have the white linen all the way around. And then you have the embroidered things. And then you have the gold at the heart of the tabernacle. But when you saw the high priest, the gold was on the outside, the white linen was on the inside. It was the flips, it was basically the tabernacle turned inside out. A walking tabernacle so that everyone could see the glory of God. And we, of course, are called to be the priest of the Most High God so that people can see God's glory that we display to the world in our lives. We get the garments of the high priest. First, the ephod. He made the ephod of gold, blue, and purple, and scarlet, and fine twined linen. And they did beat the gold into thin plates and cut it into wires to work it in the blue and in the purple and in the scarlet and in the fine linen with cunning work. They made shoulder pieces for it to couple it together. By the two edges was it coupled together. And the curious girdle of his ephod that was upon it was of the same, according to the work thereof, of gold, blue, purple, scarlet, and fine twined linen, as the Lord commanded Moses. Notice that phrase, as the Lord commanded Moses. And they wrought onyx stones enclosed in ouches of gold, graven as signets are graven, with the names of the children of Israel. And he put them on the shoulders of the ephod, that they should be stones for a memorial to the children of Israel, as the Lord commanded Moses. So we're told about the apron of the ephod. Then we're told about the breastplate. He made the breastplate of cunning work, like the work of the ephod of gold, blue, purple, scarlet, fine twined linen. It was four square. They made the breastplate double. A span was the length thereof. So a span, so a cubit, as most of you know, a cubit is about 18 inches from here to here. A span is about 9 inches from your pinky finger to your thumb, depending on how big your hands are. So a span, so this breastplate is about like this. So it's a little square. So you have a span, the breadth thereof being doubled. And they set in it four rows of stones. The first row was a sardius, a topaz, and a carbuncle. This was the first row. The second row, an emerald, a sapphire, and a diamond. The third row, a ligure, an agate, and an amethyst. The fourth row, a beryl, an onyx, and a jasper. They were enclosed in ouches of gold in their enclosings. We talked about the symbolism that connects the 12 stones of the high priest's breastplate to the stones that were found at the Garden of Eden in Ezekiel, to the stones that are found at the foundation of the New Jerusalem in the book of Revelation. And the stones were according to the names of the children of Israel, 12 according to their names, like the engravings of a signet, everyone with his name according to the 12 tribes. And they made upon the breastplate chains at the end of wreathen work of pure gold. And they made two ouches of gold and two gold rings, and they put the two rings in the two ends of the breastplate. And they put the two wreathen chains of gold and the two rings in the ends of the breastplate. And the two ends of the two wreathen chains they fastened in the two ouches, and they put them on the shoulder pieces of the ephod before it. And they made two rings of gold and put them on the two ends of the breastplate upon the border of it, which was on the side of the ephod inward. And they made two other golden rings and put them on the two sides of the ephod underneath, toward the forefront of it, over against the other coupling thereof, above the curious girdle of the ephod. And they did bind the breastplate by its rings into the rings of the ephod with a lace of blue, that it might be above the curious girdle of the ephod, that the breastplate might not be loose from the ephod, as the Lord commanded Moses. There's our phrase again. So we have the ephod, which is sort of an apron-like thing. Then we have this breastplate that was attached to the ephod. So the ephod was primarily a support for this glorious breastplate of enormous precious stones, 12 different precious stones. Just think about what that would have looked like when the light hit it. It would have been astonishingly beautiful. Then we have the robe. He made the robe of the ephod, of woven work, all of blue. And there was a hole in the midst of the robe, as the hole of an habergeon, with a band round about the hole, that it should not rend. And they made upon the hems of the robe pomegranates of blue and purple and scarlet and twined linen. And they made bells of pure gold and put the bells between the pomegranates upon the hem of the robe round about between the pomegranates. Of course, the pomegranates are redolent of the Garden of Eden with all of its fruit trees. A bell and a pomegranate, a bell and a pomegranate. Around the hem of the robe to minister in as the Lord commanded Moses. So the garments of the high priest in particular, as I mentioned earlier, were conformed to the tabernacle. So the high priest was clothed with the tabernacle, symbolically. But something else happens. Later on, we're told that the garments of the people were conformed to the garments of the priest. So the people couldn't dress like the high priest with all the gold and the finery that the high priest had. But the high priest had a fringe on the border of his garment. And God called all the people to have a fringe on the border of their garments. Numbers chapter 15 and verse 37. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and bid them that they make them fringes in the border of their garments throughout their generations, and that they put upon the fringe of the borders a riband of blue, and it shall be unto you for a fringe, that ye may look on it, and remember all the commandments of the Lord, and do them, that ye seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which ye used to go a-whoring, that ye may remember and do all my commandments, and be holy unto your God. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God. So the high priest was to have garments that were made for glory and for beauty, holy garments, garments, holy garments. And the people were to dress in holy garments. And I think that fringe and that ribbon was designed to remind them of the blue robe of the high priest that he wore, so that they would remember that they were called to be a nation of priests, a holy nation, who would bear God's name before the nations as the high priest bore their name before God. We have the rest of the garments beginning in verse 27. They made coats of fine linen of woven work for Aaron and for his sons. Literally, they made coats, the work of a weaver. Of coats of fine linen, the work of a weaver. And then a mitre of fine linen, and goodly bonnets of fine linen, and linen breeches of fine twined linen, and a girdle of fine twined linen, and blue and purple, and scarlet of needlework, as the Lord commanded Moses. So, where it says, of needlework, it's literally the work of an embroiderer. So it's like, they made this thing, and this is a thing that required this particular type of work. People were putting their skills to work, right? You don't learn the work of an embroiderer. Well, now you do if a machine does it. But these are highly technical. The point that I'm drawing your attention to is these are highly technical, specialized skills that took years and maybe even decades to learn to do well. And in the construction of the tabernacle, they're all being brought together for one purpose. And that's what God does. In each local church, as he brings the members together, each with the skills, the thumb and the foot, and the arm and the leg, the lung and the heart, all the different members of the body, the eye, they each have their function. And they each developed, unlike the body, like a human body, but if we're thinking about this, they each develop the function and the skills that the body needs in many different walks of life, some in very hard circumstances. And God brings them together and puts them together for his purpose, to glorify him and build his people on earth. The phrase, as the Lord commanded Moses, occurs exactly 7 times in chapter 39, and again 7 times exactly in chapter 40. So perhaps another reason why the garments of the high priest are separated off in this way is you have a section with, as the Lord commanded Moses, which doesn't occur at all in the whole previous section, but it occurs exactly 7 times in chapter 39 in this one distinct section that's separated off by these summaries, and then we'll see it occurs exactly 7 times in chapter 40 after this summary. That is almost certainly not accidental. It's been arranged also to draw our attention to a symbolic use of this phrase. Verse 30. And they made the plate of the holy crown of pure gold and wrote it upon a writing like to the engravings of a signet, holiness to the Lord. And they tied unto it a lace of blue to fashion it on high upon the mitre as the Lord commanded Moses. There's the 7th occurrence of this phrase in this chapter. So we have the materials and we have the people and they get to work and then they build the tabernacle in these 10 steps. And then we find the summary of the gold, the silver, and the bronze. Then we find the garments of the high priest. And now we find a summary of the tasks completed. 39 and verse 32. Thus was all the work of the tabernacle of the tent of the congregation finished. Now, there are a number of connections in these final chapters to the accounts of the creation and the flood. We've seen a number of those before, but there's some things going on in these last verses as well. As we saw earlier, there are many symbolic links with the individual elements of the tabernacle. So, 39:32, thus was all the work of the tabernacle of the tent of the congregation finished. And then we find Genesis 2:1, thus the heavens and the earth were finished and all the host of them. So just these echoes of language that by themselves wouldn't add up to much, but when we start looking at the echoes within the items themselves or the echoes in the arrangement of the way that the pattern is set up, and you start adding all of those together, you realize there is something that is going on here, and thus that strengthens seeing those connections in any one of those individual units. And the children of Israel did according to all that the Lord commanded Moses. So did they. Genesis 6:22, thus did Noah, according to all that God commanded him, so did he. So this fulfillment formula that we already have seen with Noah, we find with Moses as well. Of course, we saw many connections between Noah and Moses in the previous chapters. Verse 33, and they brought the tabernacle unto Moses, the tent and all his furniture, his taches, his boards, his bars, his pillars, and his sockets. And the covering of ram's skins dyed red, and the covering of badger skins, and the veil of the covering. The ark of the testimony, the staves thereof, and the mercy seat, pardon me, the table and all the vessels thereof, and the showbread, the pure candlestick with all the lamps thereof, even the lamps to be set in order, and all the vessels thereof, and the oil for light, and the golden altar, and the anointing oil, and the sweet incense, and the hanging for the tabernacle door, the brazen altar, and his grate of brass, his staves and all his vessels, the laver and his foot, the hangings of the court, his pillars, his sockets, and the hangings, and the hanging for the court gate, his cords and his pins, and all the vessels of the service of the tabernacle for the tent of the congregation, the cloths of service to do service in the holy place, and the holy garments for Aaron the priest, and his son's garments to minister in the priest's office, according to all that the Lord commanded Moses, so the children of Israel made all the work. Everything Moses told them to make, they made, and they made it all according to the pattern. Verse 43. And Moses did look upon all the work, and behold, they had done it as the Lord had commanded. Even so had they done it. Genesis 1:31. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. In Hebrew, did look, where it says Moses did look upon the work, and God saw, are identical. So it's, and Moses saw all the work, and God saw everything that he had made. So the connection in Hebrew is much closer than it is in English, where there's a seeing And there's a blessing of what is made. And Moses blessed them. And of course, God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it or made it holy because that in it he had rested from all his work which God had created and made. And of course, Moses in the next chapter is given instructions to sanctify the tabernacle. The Sabbath is a day of rest. The tabernacle is the place of rest. And Moses is going to sanctify that. He's going to set the tabernacle up and that he's going to be told to sanctify it. And that's what Leviticus is going to bring us into as Moses actually goes about to sanctify the tabernacle. Leviticus is also centered around the tabernacle in a lot of really fascinating ways, as we'll discover when we get around to working through Leviticus. And so next week, Lord willing, we will review and sum up. I wanted to get through this overview, this repetition of the tabernacle, because as we finish, Lord willing, the series next week, I didn't want to have so much material to cover that we couldn't review the book as a whole. So we'll sum up the book as a whole, and then we'll go through the exciting things that happen in chapter 40 as the tabernacle is actually set up. Any questions before we wrap up for tonight? You know, we covered a lot of material. Much of it was a summary of some of the things that we've already discussed. Any questions before we wrap up? Well, we'll pray and be done. Father, I come before you. I thank you for this glorious book and the beautiful tabernacle you ordered to be built. I thank you for the tabernacles you're even now building, the tabernacle you're building here in Bremerton. I thank you that you have privileged each of us to be a part in your heavenly building project. Help us to be faithful. Help us to deal faithfully with the materials that have been gathered. Help us to give cheerfully. And help us to serve you with all our hearts, with overflowing joy. In Christ's name, amen.
Thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about the Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember that a sermon podcast is no substitute for opening up a Bible and reading it for yourself.